Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. In the previous episode, episode 6, The Voice of America, we diverted a bit and talked about how the VOA was used parallel to other media broadcasts run by the CIA to effect regime change in Latin American nations. One of those nations was Chile, where in 1973, the Nixon administration used a variety of covert methods to destabilize the country. This ultimately led to a violent military coup that resulted in the death of democratically elected presidents and the installation of a brutal military dictatorship that lasted for over a decade. This week's episode was originally a three-part podcast series that was a part of my capstone project for my history degree from California State University Channel Islands. All three parts are presented here. So, without further delay, let's start with part one, which details the history behind Salvador Allende's election and the Nixon administration's attempt to thwart his election at the ballot box in 1970.
Welcome. This is the first episode of a three-part series detailing the actions of the intelligence services of the United States in Chile and their involvement in the coup that deposed duly elected President Salvador Allende. Americans' involvement in that event 50 years ago still acts as a festering wound, impacting U.S. relations with nations in Latin America. Historians continue to debate the event and its impact, and this podcast joins that discussion. Why is Chile important? Why do we examine Allende in the years that followed? Because until there is true transparency of U.S. involvement and an atonement for our culpability, the U.S. will remain hamstrung in any attempts to partner with Latin American nations for a mutual good, regardless of the opportunities that may present themselves. This first episode will discuss some relevant history about Allende's three prior unsuccessful runs for the presidency and the steps the Richard Nixon administration took to prevent the inauguration of Allende after his election victory in 1970. The second episode will deal with the deaths of three American citizens murdered by the military junta that rose to power after the coup, and how U.S. intelligence services hid the truth of their fates from their families and the American people. Also, it will examine the brazen immorality of the Nixon administration through the story of syndicated columnist Jack Anderson. Finally, the third and concluding episode will examine the successful coup in 1973 and the ramifications that still affect U.S. relations with Latin America. In 1951, Jacobo Arbenz was sworn in as the duly elected president of Guatemala. His campaign promised land reforms, and when he took office, his administration took steps to purchase land owned by the United Fruit Company and redistribute that land back to peasant farmers to create a stronger middle class. The company owned huge tracts of land in Guatemala that was appraised at a fraction of its real value. When Arbenz confiscated some of the company's land holdings and compensated the company at its appraised value, United Fruit complained that its real value was 20 times the compensation amount. United Fruit also had large ownership stakes in Guatemalan infrastructure. To protect their financial interests, the company lobbied the U.S. government to act. Arbenz was committed to fostering democracy. Although he led a coup that deposed the military dictatorship, Arbenz stepped down to allow the election of a civilian to the presidency, and later was elected as president himself. As president, he was considered a moderate in Guatemala, but the United States saw him as an instrument for a communist takeover, even though he did not promote any communists in his administration. Ultimately, to protect U.S. corporate interests and prevent any possible foothold of communism in Latin America, the CIA orchestrated a coup under the codename Operation PB Success and removed Arbenz from power. The U.S. vice president during the operation was future President Richard Nixon. It is difficult to overstate how strongly the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union affected U.S. decision-making. Almost immediately after the end of the Second World War, the standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union began. This was solidified in 1947 when U.S. President Harry Truman issued what became known as the Truman Doctrine, which declared that it was the duty of the U.S. to support nations, quote, who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures, unquote. In other words, containing communism was now U.S. policy. In Latin America, fighting the Cold War was driving U.S. policy, and the CIA was the vehicle of political upheaval against Latin American governments. This crusade against communism was only strengthened by the Cuban Revolution and events that followed. In 1959, after a six-year insurgency, Fidel Castro successfully drove U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista from power. Through it all, Castro and his revolutionaries had promised to bring much-needed reforms to the island nation, including agrarian and economic reforms that were unpopular with U.S. corporate entities. The relationship between the Castro government and the United States cooled. In April 1961, the CIA attempted to duplicate their previous success against Arbenz in Guatemala, with disastrous results. The force of CIA-trained counter-revolutionaries were easily captured by Castro's forces. As a result, Castro announced his government fully supported communism, and he allied with the Soviet Union for protection from future U.S. invasion. The Cuban Revolution and Castro's alliance with the Soviets was the prism through which the U.S. viewed all Latin American events from that point forward. Salvador Allende first ran for president in 1952. Although he was a professed socialist candidate, he received less than 6% of the vote. In 1958, however, he solidified his support from the socialists and Marxists in the country. He finished just behind conservative Jorge Alessandri and ahead of moderate Eduardo Frei. According to the Chilean constitution, if no one candidate received more than 50% of the vote, then one of the top two candidates would be chosen in a runoff election in Congress. It is important to understand that unlike the United States, where a candidate represents a single political party, candidates in Chilean elections run representing several parties that form a coalition around a single presidential candidate. This system produced a stable democracy, one that had lasted for quite a long time. Following tradition as expected, in 1958 the Congress selected Alessandri as the president. For the second time, Allende had been shut out of the presidency, but the narrowness of Alessandri's victory most assuredly caught the attention of the United States. In 1964, the CIA heavily funded the campaign of moderate candidate Eduardo Frei. As a result, Frei won a convincing election over Allende, capturing 56% of the electorate and thus avoiding any runoff in the Chilean Congress. Three times now Allende had run, all with the same result, but things were finally going to change in his favor. Frei, a member of the Christian Democrat Party, ran as a reformist candidate in 1964. He tapped into a program created during the administration of U.S. President JFK called the Alliance for Progress. AFP was a massive aid program designed with the idea that economic investment in Latin America would help reduce poverty. The hope was that as more people escaped poverty, the less they would want to turn towards communism. Frei promised a revolution in liberty and pushed the government to the left as he introduced agrarian and economic reforms. These ideas were popular with the Chilean people, yet the pace of the reforms was such that it did not produce noticeable change. Also, an economic downturn during Frei's presidency helped create social unrest. As a result, the conditions created a strong appeal for the development reforms and capitalist modernization that Allende championed. In the 1970 election, former President Jorge Alessandri once again ran as the standard bearer for the conservatives. At the beginning of the 1970 campaign, the U.S. Embassy was confident that Alessandri would win an outright majority, as Frei had done previously. It would not come to be. The late 1960s were a time of great social upheaval across the globe, and the Chilean economy had worsened during the previous 6 years. As the campaign dragged on towards Election Day, it became clear that Allende's tireless campaigning and his endless army of volunteers had made the race too close to call. In his book, Weavers of Revolution, renowned historian Peter Wynn states, quote, "The elections took place in an atmosphere of heightened expectation. As results came in from the capital's poorer districts and outlying provinces, Allende moved into a narrow lead that he never lost, capturing 36.3% of the vote to Alessandri's 34.9%, unquote. Salvador Allende had become the first socialist candidate to rise to power through a democratic election. The response of the U.S. government was almost immediate. On September 15, 1970, less than 2 weeks after Allende's stunning victory, in a meeting that included Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, Attorney General John Mitchell, and CIA Director Richard Helms, Nixon ordered them to make sure Allende was removed by a coup that would prevent him from being sworn in, or that would bring down his administration shortly afterward. After the election, the CIA, under the direction from the Nixon White House, started to plan for two roads that would lead to the result denying Allende the presidency. Dubbed Track 1 and Track 2, the first would result in the government under military rule through dubious constitutional means. The second would put the country under military rule after a violent coup. Track 1 would have outgoing President Eduardo Frei replace all his ministers with members of the military and resign, leaving the country under military rule, who would then call for a special national runoff election between Alessandri and Allende. Since this would bypass the usual vote in Congress, because Allende did not win 50% of the vote outright, it would result in an Alessandri victory. The problem with this was that it required the cooperation of Frei, and the president was committed to respecting the constitutional progress and the country's tradition of democratic elections. Track 2 had a three-step plan. Identify and work with coup-minded officers in the Chilean military, inform them the U.S. was fully supportive of a coup, and finally create a climate where the coup could be a success by using propaganda, disinformation, and terrorist activities to provide a pretext for action from the Chilean military. The day before the September White House meeting, Kissinger was given a memo by his top deputy for Latin American affairs, Viron Vickie, that summoned the CIA position on possible responses to the Allende victory. Some of the assessments included the following. First on the list was that a military coup to prevent Allende's inauguration was impossible, as the Chilean military is incapable and unwilling to seize power. We have no capability to motivate or instigate a coup. Second, that the dubious plan to use the unusual political mover, the so-called Track 1 plan, has a considerably less than even chance of success. What is more alarming were the perceived consequences of any action. Vickie's memo states that using some untried political tactic to deny Allende the presidency would result in widespread violence and insurrection. Also, if the actions are tied to the United States, it would destroy U.S. credibility and solidify anti-U.S. sentiment in Latin America permanently. In short, the memo states that exposure would be, quote, disastrous, unquote. It was evident early on that the Track 1 plan to keep Allende from getting inaugurated was a non-starter. The plan would have the outgoing president, Eduardo Frei, replace all his ministers with members of the military, then resign, leaving the country under military rule, who would then call for a special national runoff election between Alessandri and Allende. The problem with this was that it required the cooperation of Frei, and the outgoing president was committed to respecting the constitutional process and the country's tradition of democratic freedoms. In the Track 2 plan, having a military coup to prevent Allende from taking office also had a major roadblock. General René Schneider, head of the Chilean military, was deeply loyal to the Constitution and the nation's democratic tradition. Therefore, to remove him from the equation, the CIA worked with friendly military elements to abduct Schneider, fly him to Argentina, and blame his disappearance on Allende supporters. The military would then control the government to prevent Congress from voting in the special runoff election. The actual execution of the plan was a disaster. On the day the kidnappers attempted to abduct Schneider, he drew a pistol to defend himself, and as a result, he was shot several times. He was rushed to a hospital and underwent open-heart surgery, but died 3 days later. The day before his death, on October 25th, Congress met to vote in the runoff election between Allende and runner-up Jorge Alessandri. If the plotters assumed that the attack on General Schneider had improved the chances of a coup before the vote, they completely miscalculated the mood of the Chilean people and their pride in the country's democratic tradition. Besides, Allende was not some radical outsider. Instead, he had been a senator and part of the political establishment in Chile for his entire political career. Congress voted overwhelmingly to confirm Allende as president and show their abject repudiation for the violence. With that vote, Salvador Allende won the office he had sought for 2 decades and shocked the world as the first socialist to become a national leader through the democratic process. In the next episode of this series, we will examine the level of criminality of the CIA and the Nixon administration by examining their actions regarding American citizens caught up in the coup's aftermath. In the final episode, we will examine the coup that deposed Allende 3 years after he took office and how those events still shape the political environment today. I would like to end this episode with one final bit of irony of the events that October. Peter Kornbluth points out that the U.S. State Department, which was oblivious to the fact that the events in Chile were being put in motion by Nixon himself, recommended to Henry Kissinger that the president send a short message of condolence to outgoing Chilean President Eduardo Frei, which read, quote, "The shocking attempt on the life of General Schneider is a stain on the pages of contemporary history. I would like you to know of my sorrow that this repugnant event has occurred in your country," unquote. Sadly, what would follow would be much worse. Welcome to part 2 of this 3-part series on the activities of the U.S. intelligence services surrounding the coup against the Allende government in Chile in the early 1970s. In part 1, we examine the actions of the Nixon administration and the CIA behind the scenes and their failed coup attempt to prevent Salvador Allende's 1970 inauguration as the president of Chile. 3 years after the events discussed in the last podcast, the CIA had created the conditions necessary for a successful coup, and Allende was deposed on September 11, 1973. The irony of the date 9/11 is not lost on those who study history. This episode switches gears to talk about the fates of 3 American citizens that got caught up in the corruption of the U.S. government and the unlawful steps the Nixon administration would take to cover up the truth about what transpired in Chile. The immorality of these events refutes the moral high ground the U.S. tries to claim and contributes to the level of distrust that exists to this day between Latin American nations and the United States. Charles Horman was an independent journalist living in Chile during the coup against Allende and the subsequent rise of Pinochet. Of those who disappeared during this time, he is the most well-known, as his story and that of his family trying to discover the truth about his murder was turned into the Hollywood movie Missing. He was working with another American, Frank Tarugi, for a small news service, the North American Information Sources. His wife also stated that he was researching to write a book about the 1970 assassination of General René Schneider. On the day of the coup, Horman and a family friend were visiting a town on the Chilean coast where they were trapped because movement during the coup was impossible. They searched for other Americans hoping to gather information on what was happening when they came across some U.S. Navy personnel who told him that they were in the country and had finished the job they were sent to do. After 4 frantic days, they arranged a ride with U.S. Navy Captain Ray Davis, one of the few people who had clearance to travel freely in the country. When they arrived at the U.S. Embassy, Davis informed Horman that they had no plans in place to get Americans out of the country. When Horman and his wife Joyce returned to the embassy on September 17th, an embassy secretary told them that they would have to travel to a U.S. consulate that was a mile away. That night, Chilean soldiers arrived at the Horman residence and arrested him. His wife was not there at the time. She never saw him alive again. Frantic, she turned to American officials for help. What she got was a half-hearted attempt to locate Horman. When she asked the U.S. ambassador to go to the National Soccer Stadium, where all political detainees were held, he refused, telling her that they were trying to remain on good terms with the new Chilean government. Horman's friend, that had been trapped with him for 4 days on the coast, called Captain Davis to enlist his help. Finally, on September 30th, a Chilean official informed the Americans that Charles Horman had been executed at the soccer stadium. Officials estimate his murder had probably taken place on September 20th. For the nearly 4 decades that followed his murder, Joyce Horman fought for the truth. In 1979, Horman's family filed a lawsuit against the CIA, hoping to subpoena records that would uncover the truth. A CIA memo regarding the possibility of an investigative subpoena states, quote, "According to his wife, he He was conducting research for a book on the kidnapping and murder of General René Schneider, unquote, and, quote, the sole evidence the plaintiffs have, which they contend suggests American involvement in Horman's death, is a statement from Rafael Agustin Gonzalez, a former Chilean military intelligence officer who claims he was present when Horman was sentenced to death, unquote. Like Horman, Frank Tarugi was also a journalist who worked for North American information sources. He was also a graduate student, studying Chile's economic transition under the Allende presidency. He was living with another American at the time of his murder named David Hathaway. On the night of September 20th, both Tarugi and Hathaway were arrested and taken to the National Soccer Stadium for interrogation. Hathaway testified later that Tarugi had been separated from the rest of the American detainees based on a list of names. On September 25th, U.S. Counsel Fred Purdy received a call from the General Morgue stating that they had received the body of Frank Tarugi 3 days earlier. On September 27th, Hathaway was brought in to confirm that the bullet-ridden corpse was in fact Tarugi, but Hathaway could not do so. It was not until October 2nd that another friend, Steve Volk, was able to make a positive identification. As with Horman, the CIA refused to help Tarugi's family and went as far to say that they did not have any reports on him whatsoever. Finally, they admitted to a Tarugi family attorney that they did have one piece of information, but it came from a foreign source and was classified for national security reasons. However, it did not contain any information about his murder, nor could it be construed as negative. This was a lie. The information was gathered by West German intelligence officials, and it was a report written in 1972 by the FBI that described Tarugi as a radical who was under FBI surveillance. Both Charles Horman and Frank Tarugi were arrested and murdered within days of each other. After decades of denial and deflection from the U.S. government on their fates, light was finally shed on the truth. In 2011, Chilean judge Jorge Zepeda handed down an indictment charging former U.S. Navy captain Ray Davis, the man who drove Horman back to Santiago, the man that Joyce Horman pleaded for help in getting out of the country, as an accessory to their murders. Davis relayed the identities of the two Americans, who the CIA had labeled as subversives, to Chilean intelligence officers. Zepeda's investigation concluded that their murders were part of an operation carried out by American personnel to investigate the political activities of American citizens in the United States and Chile. A Penn State University mathematics professor, Boris Weisleifer, was also an avid hiker, known for hiking some of the most remote terrains alone. On Christmas Eve in 1984, he took off on a hiking tour of southern Chile. During this time, the country was still run by the military junta of Augusto Pinochet. 2 weeks after he headed alone into the wilderness, he vanished. His backpack was supposedly discovered on a riverbank, and Chilean authorities quickly tried to claim that it was a case of accidental drowning, even though his body was never found. Declassified documents show that the State Department sent a cable to the U.S. Embassy in Santiago on January 19, 1985, stating that Weisleifer's colleagues reported him as missing as he had not returned to the university in time to teach classes. For 2 years, the Chilean government held to the story that Weisleifer had drowned, yet the U.S. refused to consider the case closed. In July of 1987, the embassy in Santiago sent a cable to the U.S. with the details of an interview conducted with a former member of the Chilean army who claimed to have knowledge of Weisleifer's fate. At the end, the embassy concludes, quote, his story is so detailed and fits so well with what we know from many other sources of Weisleifer's whereabouts, physical description, and what he was carrying, that it seems likely the source did in fact participate in Weisleifer's arrest, unquote. By June 2000, the State Department had over 400 documents relating to the Weisleifer case, yet none of that information was ever shared with his family. It was obvious to embassy officials from the beginning that the Chilean accounts regarding Weisleifer's drowning were suspect, and his case remained open. However, in 1989, when pressured to investigate the case, the State Department relented, stating that they had no problem with reopening the investigation. What they refused to do was fund the investigation, and they demanded Weisleifer's family pay for the legal fees that would be incurred. Finally, in 2012, Chilean judge Jorge Zepeda indicted 8 retired police officers, and the case was closed. The truth about what happened to Weisleifer will probably never be known. Unlike Horman and Tarugi, the CIA was not involved in his murder. Nevertheless, how the U.S. government handled his family for three decades was criminal. They spent years stringing the family of Professor Weisleifer on when they suspected from the very beginning what had happened. Perhaps the most shocking example of the moral corruption of the Nixon administration and their plans to create a coup to remove Allende involved syndicated journalist Jack Anderson. Anderson's investigative reporting was a constant thorn in Nixon's proverbial side. In September of 1972, Anderson broke a story about the administration colluding with the corporate giant ITT to undermine the Chilean economy and create unrest in the country. The Nixon White House had tried all sorts of plots to discredit Anderson. They wiretapped his house, fed him disinformation, and attacked his personal reputation. As a result, Anderson regularly mocked them in his columns. But after Anderson broke the ITT story, the administration debated another method to silence him: murder. They debated several methods. White House aide G. Gordon Libby even volunteered to stab him to death in the street and make it look like a robbery. A Senate committee later confirmed there was a plot to poison Anderson. Libby confirmed the conspiracy and his participation, but it was never carried out. This affair is nowhere as tragic as the fate that befell the Chilean people after the Nixon administration caused the coup that removed Allende and brought about more than a decade-long oppressive dictatorship. Nevertheless, it is shocking to think that a presidential administration would even consider the assassination of a popular journalist as policy. However, it shows how lawless and morally bankrupt the administration was. This was the second part of a three-part podcast series. The first episode examined the attempts of the U.S. to keep Allende from becoming president. For the third and last episode of the series, we will discuss the actual coup on September 11, 1973, and the ramifications that can still be felt when it comes to U.S. relations with Latin America today. Welcome to the concluding episode of our three-part series covering the U.S. action in Chile that resulted in a coup that deposed democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende. In part one of this series, we covered the U.S. actions that attempted and failed to keep Allende from taking power after his election. Part 2 highlighted four Americans caught up in the events to show the immorality of the Nixon administration. In this final episode, we will cover the events behind the scenes that led to the coup in 1973 and the ramifications that still affect the relationship between the United States and Latin America. Finally, we will discuss what actions the U.S. needs to take to be a trusted partner with the rest of the Americas. Today, what we know of the September 11th coup against Allende comes from declassified government documents. Some of them are highly redacted, and others are still classified. For example, the president's daily briefing put together by the CIA on September 8th, 3 days before the coup, is, quote, declassified in part, unquote. Their assessments on Indochina, Europe, and Libya are declassified. The information on Chile, however, is still classified as top secret. The briefing for September 11th is still classified as well. After Allende won the election and was sworn in, the Nixon administration scrambled to devise a plan. The CIA had spent over a decade working behind the scenes to keep Allende from getting elected. They had no contingency plans to deal with an Allende victory and were uncertain how they should handle the newly elected government. Some members in the intelligence agencies doubted that Chile was destined to be another Cuba at this stage. Allende had been contacted by the Soviet government as early as 1953, yet he was never recruited by the KGB, nor took any payments. Allende passed a message on to Charles Meyer, a U.S. State Department official, stating that he would never allow Chilean soil to be used by any power hostile to the United States. He added that his ruling party coalition would not export its political system to neighboring countries, joking that it would be impossible to export the UP as it was in Chile. First, he would have to export democracy. After all, Allende himself had been a figure working within the Chilean democratic system for his entire political career. But if Allende spoke out against a violent path to socialism, there were radicals in his coalition that did not. It is important to understand how the Chilean political system worked. Allende was not a candidate of a single political party. In Chile, different parties and factions coalesced around Allende as their standard-bearer in the presidential election. The Popular Unity government was a coalition of five individual parties. Each had its own priorities, goals, tactics, and beliefs on where the socialist movement was headed. So even if Allende spoke out against a violent expansion of Marxism, Carlos Altamirano, a cabinet member in the Allende administration, publicly stated his belief that civil war was inevitable and the left needed to prepare for armed insurrection. If Allende was trying to portray his movement as a peaceful democratic transition, these kinds of statements did not ease tensions with the United States. Finally, there is a connection to Cuba. When Allende came to power, he restored diplomatic ties to Cuba and its leader, Fidel Castro, visited the country in November 1971. The United States isolated Castro in Cuba, and any relationship with the country would be met with U.S. disapproval. Allende, meeting with Castro, only supported the Nixon administration's preconceived conclusions about Allende's goal of Marxist expansion. A decade earlier, Cuba was at the center of a nuclear standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. This standoff nearly led to nuclear war when U.S. President John F. Kennedy imposed a military blockade of Cuba after it was discovered that the Soviet Union had installed nuclear missiles which could be used to attack the United States. About the Cold War, Gustafson writes, "In the post-Cold War era, it is easy to trivialize or dismiss this struggle as foolish ideological sparring, but at the time it was extraordinarily real and the ultimate cost of getting it wrong was nuclear war." To the United States in the 1960s, political subversion of pro-Western democracies was seen as a direct challenge to U.S. security, allies, and civilization. Just days after Allende won the election in September 1970, a White House meeting to discuss Chile was held. Nixon's handwritten note of that meeting read as follows: "One in 10 chance, perhaps, but save Chile. Worth spending. Not concerned risks involved. No involvement of embassy. 10 million available, more if necessary. Full-time job. Best men we have. Game plan. Make the economy scream. 48 hours plan of action." Thus, it became the administration's official policy to create the conditions necessary for the Chilean people to accept or demand the removal of Allende. There were many ways Nixon and Henry Kissinger interfered with the internal politics of Chile during the Allende years. Here are a few examples.
Agustin Edwards Eastman was a Chilean media magnate and owner of the El Mercurio newspaper. He was an outspoken critic of Allende. He also partnered with the CIA, which funded his newspaper with millions of dollars. The paper was a mouthpiece for anti-Allende, anti-communist propaganda. This connection was confirmed with the release of declassified CIA documents.
Another method was to sabotage the Chilean economy. The Nixon administration cut off any type of aid to the country. They also dried up avenues of credit, making it nearly impossible for Chilean industry to obtain new equipment or spare parts to maintain older equipment. The World Bank loaned Chile $31 million from 1969 to 1970, and zero between 1971 and 1973. Also, U.S. aid went from $110 million to $3 million in the same period. As mentioned earlier, one of Nixon's directives was, quote, "make the economy scream," unquote. The U.S. dried up avenues for credit and stopped all developmental aid, throwing an already weak economy into turmoil. The Chilean people felt the ensuing economic pain. The wealthy could ride out bad times, and the poor suffered regardless. It was the middle class that felt squeezed the most. They were the true target of Nixon's policy edict because they would direct their growing dissatisfaction and anger at Allende and his policies. Up to this point, the Nixon administration had been successful in their attempts to pressure the Allende government covertly. But that all changed on March 21, 1972, when syndicated journalist Jack Anderson wrote a story showing that the CIA had partnered with U.S. company International Telephone and Telegraph and was using the company as a middleman in their efforts in Chile. For example, ITT was where the payments to El Mercurio originated to keep the propaganda outlet running. Anderson had received 79 pages of records, document meetings, correspondence, and conversations between Nixon administration officials, ITT, and the U.S. Embassy in Santiago that showed their plans to create economic chaos and subvert the Allende administration. The fallout from this disclosure caused the U.S. Congress to hold hearings into the abuse of power by the CIA, but the worst part for the Nixon administration was that it brought their actions somewhat to light, which was their greatest fear from the beginning. This disclosure forced the CIA to shut down many of its efforts, but the damage in Chile had already been done. By the next year, the deteriorating economy created enough social unrest and division that a coup was inevitable. On September 8, 1973, a Defense Intelligence Agency report stated they expected the coup to occur on the 10th. On the morning of the 11th, as the bombs fell around the capital, Allende made a final address to the nation from the La Moneda Presidential Palace. It is an astonishing address, filled with hope for the future from a leader resolute in the face of death, refusing to surrender, and proclaiming that the nation and its workers would one day be themselves triumphant again. Workers of my country, I have faith in Chile and its destiny. Other men will overcome this dark and bitter moment when treason seeks to prevail. Keep in mind that much sooner than later, great avenues will again open, from which will pass the free man to construct a better society. Long live Chile. Long live the people. Long live the workers. These are my last words, and I am certain that my sacrifice will not be in vain. I am certain that, at the very least, it will be a moral lesson that will punish felony cowardice and treason. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Allende's defiant stand and the end of his presidency. The U.S. involvement remains a wound that affects not only the nation's image in the world, but more importantly, it affects the ability of the U.S. to be a partner in Latin America. Last year, leftist leader Gabriel Boric became the youngest president in Chilean history. During his inauguration speech, he made several references to the 1973 coup. When talking about this moment in history, when he entered the La Moneda Presidential Palace before the inauguration ceremonies, he stated, quote, "Through here passed Eduardo Frei Montalva and the popular promotion policies, Comrade Salvador Allende and the nationalization of copper, Patricio Alwyn and the return to democracy, Michelle Bachelet opening unexplored roads with social provision policies. But these walls have also been witness to the horrors of past violence and oppression, horrors we have not forgotten and will not forget. Where we speak today, yesterday rockets came through that can never again be repeated in our history," unquote. He closed his speech by echoing the final words that Allende spoke to the Chilean people when he said, quote, "As Salvador Allende predicted almost 50 years ago, we are here once again, compatriots, opening the great avenues through which the free man and the free woman can walk to build a better society. We keep going. Long live Chile," unquote. As Boric took the oath of office, he put the U.S. and the world on notice that the wounds caused by U.S. policy in Chile 50 years ago and in Latin America for more than a century still need to heal. The United States has the capacity to be a positive force in this hemisphere, but the fact that the U.S. still has not displayed contrition over the events of the Nixon administration or from those that followed pollutes the political environment. Currently, China is investing in Latin America. Nixon and Kissinger were terrified of what they assumed Allende would bring to the region and the damage it could have inflicted on U.S. national security. But in the end, the U.S. did the greatest damage to the security of the United States. Every day the U.S. government refuses to be completely transparent about its actions in Chile is another day the healing cannot begin and trust cannot be restored. The U.S. culpability in the 1973 coup still casts a long shadow in Latin America. As I stated before, the United States does have the capacity to be a positive influence in Latin America, one that can create permanent alliances that would inevitably follow are acting as a partner in the region, instead of acting like a feudal lord robbing the serfs for its own benefit. The worst consequence of the distrust the U.S. has fostered is that it creates an opportunity for adversaries like China and Russia to gain a foothold in the region, one that will allow them to exchange debt for control. Then again, maybe those nations will realize that all that Chinese capital comes with a steep price, and that price is subservience to a foreign power. After all, it is a lesson the U.S. has been teaching them for over a century. That concludes this week's episode. To ensure you catch each new episode when it comes out, please subscribe wherever you listen to this show. Also, if you would like to add anything to the conversation, please leave a comment. With the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan coming up on the calendar, the next episode is going to take a look at the history of the bombings and how historians and the public have wrestled with that event over the last 8 decades. Until next week, thanks for listening. And remember to fight to keep your elected representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.